This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. And I'm floating in a most peculiar way. And the stars look very different today.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 6 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us about today's topic.
Well, on a previous episode, we started a discussion about observatories in Canada. And the fact is that Canadians have played a particularly strong role in the study of the universe, dating all the way back to the early 20th century, when Canadians were leading the way in a study of our own galaxy and also providing proof, or at least more evidence, that Einstein's theory of relativity held water. And there was actually way too much for us to cover in that one episode. So this week, we're going to be hearing more about our friends at the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory in Victoria. And while some of my interview with Laurie Roche and Ben Dorman was about the research accomplishments at that observatory, we're also going to be hearing about star parties and other really interesting programs that are designed for public engagement.
This sounds like this is going to be a good one, Tim. But first, I'd like to kick off the episode with an update which recently caught my eye. And that's for the first time, the Earth has not one, but two moons. And right now, at the time of airing, Earth might be a little more like Mars, which has two moons called Phobos and Deimos, which we've mentioned before on Space Talks. An asteroid, or mini-moon if you will, was discovered by four NASA-funded ground-based telescopes called ATLAS.
And I'm sure that's an acronym. Something that we love to explain. So, Steve, tell me, what does ATLAS stand for?
Well, ATLAS stands for Asteroid Terrestrial Impact Last Alert System. And that's a robotic survey and early warning system for detecting near-Earth objects before they slam into the Earth. Unfortunately, at just about 11 meters in diameter, this mini-moon, or asteroid, will be extremely difficult to see from Earth. Nonetheless, it will be present between September 29th and November 25th, 2024. Now, the Earth regularly captures NEO asteroids, thus making them mini-moons, and this particular one is called 2024 PT5.
So it's got a name. Now, I've heard of the, the PT Cruiser, so I assume the prefix of 2024 refers to the year. But what's the significance of the PT5 part of the name?
Well, it took me a lot of researching to find out what I could. And what I found was the letter P stands for provisional. And the number 5 means that this is the fifth such discovered NEO which has been captured by the Earth. But I couldn't uncover what the T stands for. Now, maybe it means track, but I'm sure that some keen listener will tell us what it really means. Regardless, Asteroid 2024 PT5 will not complete a full orbit around the Earth before it departs. So, analogously speaking, one might say that if a true moon is like a customer buying goods inside a store, then 2024 PT5 is merely a window shopper. Now, as a parting thought on this topic, the director of the Center for NEO Studies at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory has stated that 2024 PT5 is possibly a piece of ejecta from a different asteroid which impacted our moon eons before, meaning this new mini-moon just might be a, quote, chip off the old block.
Well, now on to the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory and our topic of the day. It's located just a short drive from my own house here on Vancouver Island and just a 20-minute drive from Victoria. The main driving force behind a project to locate and build the observatory in the early years of the 20th century was a fellow named John Plaskett. And I think it's fair to say that John Plaskett's name is not well known, certainly in comparison to that of, say, well, Edwin Hubble. However, both men were leading crucial experiments back in the day. Hubble was focused on the future of the universe, where it was going to be expanding or contracting. And he found it to be expanding and became famous for that, among many other things. And Plaskett at the time was working in spectroscopy, and allowed us to understand more about our own galaxy. And here's something of a fun note about how the world of science must have felt about these two great astrophysicists. They named a crater on the dark side of the moon after Edwin Hubble, and it has a diameter of 81 kilometers. And similarly, they also named a crater on the far side of the moon after John Plaskett, and that one has a diameter of 109 kilometers. So I'm just saying.
What are you saying, that size actually matters in astronomy?
Well, anyway, Steve, long after John Plaskett retired, I think it's fair to say that the public outreach programming he started were not forgotten. And the facility continues to carry out cutting-edge research. And I want us to hear more about that research from that interview we had with Laurie and Ben.
This facility has become absolutely pivotal to Canadian science. In that building are people who manage telescopes around the world, both optical and radio, and also they work with space telescopes as well.
The observatory was updated, I'm sure, on an ongoing basis, because we're talking about a place that was carrying out science in 1918 and yet is still carrying out cutting-edge science in this day.
We tell our visitors, we take them upstairs to the observing floor and say, look, here's the telescope. Nearly everything you see is 106, 108 years old. The only things that are not that old are the mirror, which is only 50 years old, the electric motors, which are only 50 years old. But the instruments are modern. They are renewed all the time. They even have people on site who build and design new instruments. In fact, that's one of the major things they do at the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory, is build instrumentation for some of the largest telescopes in the world, but including the one in their own backyard.
So say, Ben, the optical part of our telescope that takes the pictures is probably about 10,000 times better in terms of its resolution compared to what it was in 1918. They did it with glass plates back then, having to be worked on with silver nitrate and then put up for 2 or 3 hours to take one picture. We can take lots and lots of them in one place, and they're so much better. So that's really the difference.
The true fact, they used to, some people still remember companies like Kodak who made photographic film. They used to make special emulsions, special chemicals to smear on the glass plates for astronomers to use. And what astronomers would do is they would take these plates and they would bake them in ovens full of pure hydrogen, which was said to improve the efficiency at which it used to collect light. And I'm mentioning this because they were still doing that when I was a grad student in the 80s. It's taken until very recently for the techniques that they used to use in 1918 to be modernized into our modern electronic detectors. And our electronic detectors are some 40 to 50 times more efficient than photographic plates, which is one of the reasons why the telescope is so much more efficient than it was in 1918.
I'd like to find out how the Victoria Observatory is and has worked in concert with the other observatories across the country. There has been some means to try to take advantage of the geography of the country, having observatories in far apart places. Was there not a connection between the observatory in Penticton and the one in Nova Scotia, if I'm not mistaken?
On the radio astronomy side?
Yes.
There are also, the biggest collaborations of those are actually even broader than across Canada or worldwide, which the Canadian astronomers are taking a part. But also Canada is one of the countries involved in a new venture called the Square Kilometre Array, which is having many radio telescopes in Australia and South Africa, as well as the ALMA Array, which is in Chile. So Canadian astronomy is truly international. Some of these international collaborations essentially make baselines as big as the Earth itself.
And I understand that important part of the programming that's still active at the observatory is its role in helping to mentor new scientists who are gaining access to the facility and working with other scientists. So teaching and mentoring is a function of the observatory to this day, correct?
Well, certainly the NRC supports postdoc programs a lot. And so many of the new astronomers coming out of the program are hired by NRC and come to Victoria for some of their first jobs. And there's wonderful people in Victoria for a number of years who do take these people under their wing. And then after 2 or 3 years, you find that they've gone to Chile or they've gone to Hawaii or they've someplace else. So we do that germination program of some of the people. The NRC is very good about getting summer students that are undergraduate students who are part of that, and they help either by doing their own, like doing a bit of a research project, or they've also been very helpful with us within the public outreach part of the program, so that they, you know, take on different roles and learn how to communicate with the public and do that. And we've been very happy to have the NRC do that part.
Walk me through a typical evening and what's happening when the lights go out and the stars come out.
Before the stars go down, we have people looking at the sun. You can see the sun very clearly set below the hills that are past Prospect Lake. It's the best view in town, with or without the ability to see the stars. The solar telescopes that we have and our volunteers from RASC have can show you the granulation on the surface of the sun, the sunspots and the prominences. And we always have at least two solar telescopes trained before the sunset.
What about the later in the evening when the stars come out? Or people have to book the use of the telescope at the time? I mean, this is a precious commodity. And walk me through that process, taking advantage of the opportunity.
We have the Plaskett telescope, the 72-inch, allocated to us for the evening until 11 p.m. every Saturday night that we operate. So we get to keep the telescope for ourselves. We get to invite the public up, and we have a set of seats and a projector, and they get to actually watch us make images with the big telescope as we go. I was operating the telescope a week ago, and we got to see a galaxy cluster that's 280 million light years away, which we can image in about 5 minutes with the Plaskett telescope.
People that come there later in the night that are not the friends or the community at large, what are those scientists using the observatory for?
Although the telescope is over 100 years old, it's now fully automated. And they have adapted it so that as long as we leave the telescope in the right position, they can hit a button and have it do observations remotely. So there's a number of things that they do with the telescope. One of them is called an optical transient program. An optical transient in plain language is something that emits light which changes. An example is an exploding star in a distant galaxy. Although they're rare, we've seen six in our own galaxy the last 1,000 years. If you know how many galaxies there are, we see a lot of them, nearly 100 a year in the universe as a whole. Sometimes someone in the world will say, well, I think I spotted a new star shining out in this galaxy, and this telescope is one of those that takes a look at it. And because it has a spectroscope, there is a telltale sign of a real exploding star. It decays like radioactivity decays, and it has certain elements in it, all of which can be detected with a spectroscope. So that's one major program. People doing spectroscopy, analyzing the elements in distant stars, are very keen to use the telescope because it's got very high, what's called dispersion, the ability to see the fine details of what's the starlight that's emitted, to understand it, the motion of the star that you're looking at, and the chemistry of it.
I have a question about the utility of an observatory that is at ocean level in proximity to a city of about 400,000 people with all the ambient light that's going on. And I'm sure that the average person might say, aren't these observatories on the tops of mountains nowadays?
And knowing that Victoria gets a lot of rain. So it's interesting in that it's not the number of nights that are clear, which Victoria doesn't have as many as others do. It's our quality of seeing, what we call seeing in astronomy, which is that the steadiness of the atmosphere. And I think it's because we're kind of by a bit of an ocean that things are clear. Certainly back in Plaskett's day, there wasn't any haze from fires as much as there is now, but there is a steadiness of seeing and a quality of the air that is really good, which means that in Victoria, we can get the efficiency of the pictures and the photographs that are taken are better. We may not have as many days of clear skies, but we've got pristine clear skies when we get them. And so the quality of the photographs are really good. Plaskett actually mentioned this even before he decided where it was going to be. He said that those were the most important parts, that you try to figure out where a telescope should be rather than the number of clear nights. And he did do a lot of different work across Canada trying to find a number of sites. And when he got here and did all the instrumentation about what would happen, he found that our temperature variance is very low compared to, say, Penticton, that's very high in the summer and quite low in the winter. We have this very temperate climate, and that also is really, really important for keeping the pictures pristine and the telescope and the mirror at a constant kind of temperature. So that's why it was picked, why Victoria was picked.
Given that telescope was going to be in Canada by edict,
now, we're not trying to offend the good people of the Shuswap, but I have to say that I think this is indeed the Goldilocks zone. Well, Steve, that was a really fascinating interview, and I really want to get to the final part of my discussion with Lori when we were talking about how the public can connect with the observatory, either online or by visiting. But I'd like to make sure that we're covering off how the engine, in this case I mean the telescope, how it actually works in the observatory.
Well, I know that for starters, optical telescopes are either refractors, like binoculars, or reflectors, which use mirrors. Now, which of these two methods does the DAO employ?
They have a reflecting telescope, which means it uses a very large mirror, not lenses, to gather light. The 72-inch primary mirror collects light from distant stars and galaxies. It's shaped like a parabola, so it focuses the light on a single point. That light is then reflected by a smaller secondary mirror and directed into an eyepiece, or these days, to electronic detectors for analysis.
So the larger the mirror's diameter is, the more light it collects. And of course, this means it enables fainter objects to be seen more clearly. Again, larger is better in astronomy. You know, this reminds me of a discussion that we previously had with regard to optical lenses. For example, when buying binoculars or telescopes, most people ask, how much power does it have? Not knowing that there are two other more important factors, and they are resolving power or clarity and light gathering ability. As mentioned, light gathering is dictated by both the clarity of the lens and its width. If comparing 7x35 binoculars to 7x50 binoculars, they both have a magnification of 7. That's what the 7 means. But the first has a lens width of only 35 millimeters compared to the latter, which has a width of 50 millimeters. Images viewed in the 50 millimeter binoculars will be brighter and easier to see.
Exactly. And that's what made this telescope so groundbreaking. It could see much fainter and farther objects than previous telescopes. And of course, the farther the object is away, the older it is, as it took that much longer for its light to reach us.
So how does a telescope track objects in the sky?
The telescope sits on an equatorial mount, which means it moves along with the Earth's rotation, and the mount is aligned with the Earth's axis. And motors make precise adjustments to keep the telescope pointed at the same spot in the sky, even as the Earth rotates.
That sounds like a delicate operation to me. How is the telescope protected from the elements, though?
Well, it's housed in a large rotating dome with a slit that opens up for observing. The dome itself rotates, so the telescope can point in different directions while still being shielded from the weather and the light nearby.
So when astronomers use it, they're not looking through the eyepiece anymore, right? They're not at the end of this great long tube?
No, not usually. These days, they attach electronic detectors like CCD cameras to record images and instruments like spectrometers to analyze the light. And it's that data that tells us a lot, like the composition of the stars they're looking at or the motion of distant galaxies.
I think there's another acronym there, Tim, when you mentioned CCD cameras. And CCD stands for charged coupled device, which is extremely sensitive to photons. It's amazing to think that this telescope at the DAO is over 100 years old and continues to be used for research.
It really is. Now, although it's not the biggest telescope anymore, it's still actually very valuable for stellar astrophysics, and it's a great outreach tool for engaging the public in astronomy.
It's a provincial treasure, Tim, and I think it's wonderful that granting public access has always been, and still is, central to the observatory's mission. So, without further ado, I think you've got another segment to play, do you not, Tim?
Yeah, let's hear from Lori again as we talk about that engagement strategy.
Okay, Lori, I wanted to come back and talk with you a little bit more about what the observatory and the Friends are doing to try to make what's happening at the observatory of interest to people in the community and around the province. This is something I know you're interested in. One of the things I've read a lot about is star parties. Can we start with that? What's a star party?
Sure. Yes, we do star parties Saturday nights. 7 o'clock or so until about 11 o'clock. They start in the middle of June, and we do it every Saturday night until about the middle of September. So we have just kind of finished about our 22nd star party that we've had all in a row. So it's been a very busy summer. For the rest of the year, we do once a month. So we do take a little bit of a break with some of our star parties. But I wanted to say that John Stanley Plaskett, who we talked about before, wanted very much to have public access free on Saturdays. And he said this back in 1918. And we have continued that tradition for 108 years. So we're really happy to be able to do that. So that if anybody is coming up from the Shuswap area and wants to come in on Saturday nights, let us know and we'll get you some tickets to come up to the center during the summer. So next summer, think about that for next summer. We have guest presenters. We have planetarium so that we can show a little planetarium show for people. We have telescopes out on the deck that are from the Royal Astronomical Society members here in Victoria, and they man those. We have a gift shop open. We have a gallery and a museum, and people just can come in, browse at their heart's content. For that. So
I have been there to one of these star parties, and there's quite the contrast between the kind of presenters that you have in terms of the level of sophistication. These are people who really know a great deal and are able to share it with the folks in the room. But the visitor center in general is kind of something of interest to pretty much anyone of any age. Isn't that the case?
Absolutely. We love to have young people in for sure. We're trying to get a few more interactive displays and things like that for that time. We certainly do it with the children with schools, but also trying to do that during the star parties as well. We cater to that middle ground, I guess, for our presenters. We tell the presenters that they usually can't do any more than one graph. So that it is at a level that is for the general audience. And I even stopped somebody to say, excuse me, I didn't understand that. Can you go over that again? Because we don't want people to be out of their comfort zone for, coming up to something like this and wanting really general information. But we have a very wide range of people who speak.
So Lori, there's also a website and a YouTube way to reach people. And this is really important to reach people that are not just in the Victoria area, but obviously anyone in the Shuswap listening or across the country. Isn't that so?
That's right. Our website is centeroftheuniverse.org. All one word, center spelt with a C-N-T-R-E. And if anybody wants to email for any information, it's just info@centeroftheuniverse.org. So you can go there and all of our programs are listed. All of our events are listed. And we also have all the school programs listed for that as well. So I wouldn't mind talking a little bit about some of the school programs, because I know maybe possibly in the area where you are, there may be some school district teachers that would like to, obviously they might not be able to bring their students down to Victoria, but we can go via the Zoom calls. We can go into their classrooms in two different ways. We have an online program where we do virtual tours, and we do programs that are geared to whatever they would like to talk about in their curriculum within their grade level. And then we also have got a program called Can Yes, which is connecting a working astronomer with the kids in the classroom. Get the two of them together, and the astronomer can talk about what they're doing in research and science, and the students can talk about what it's like to be a scientist. What do they do every day? What kind of problems are there? How do you get to be an astronomer? Those kind of questions are all asked, and we've been doing that for several years now, and it's a really important program that we do that is totally online, and we can connect up. So you just have to get in touch with us, and we'll make sure that that happens.
What a fabulous program. And I bet you some of the astronomers are learning as much from the kids in terms of their perspective and questions.
Absolutely. Yes, it's really good for them. So we do have our YouTube channel where we put all of our presenters' programs on there, and people can go into the YouTube channel of the Friends of the DAO, and they can go to find out what we've been doing in the past.
It's really important to remind listeners that this is not a new phenomenon that you're trying to reach out to people. I think it's one of the most exciting parts of the history of the observatory, that it's been a central part of the observatory to try to have a mission to reach out to people and encourage people to take an interest in the science and the programming. I think it's wonderful. And thank you, Lori, for being with us today.
Well, aside from bragging about life on Vancouver Island, Tim, that was very interesting. You need to get out more, I think, my friend.
Sorry about that, Steve. I suppose I just couldn't resist. And I also want to thank Lori again for helping us out with this understanding. It was really a lot of fun to chat with her. But the important takeaway for me is that whether you want to connect with the observatory's programming online or make it part of a visit to Victoria, this is just a treasure to have here in British Columbia. Now, recently, I was up at the observatory for an evening hosted by Bob McDonald, that wonderful fellow who hosts Quirks and Quarks. And he was there for a movie night, actually, one where he was hosting. And the show, the movie, was about bending light and how measuring that bend with the help from scientists at our own observatory helped to prove Einstein's theory of relativity was holding water. And that work was done incredibly 100 years ago.
That's amazing. And we're lucky to have that research station and have so many ways to connect with the observatory. Well, we've learned a great deal about the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory today. And in future episodes, we'll explore some other BC observatories.
But that's all the time we have. So this is Tim Woods on Vancouver Island.
Stephen Lowry and Salmon Arm saying so long. We hope you piqued your interest and do a little research on your own. And until next time, we'll see you on
Space Talks.
Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?